Hello, wine lovers. As we enter into the harvest season in Northern California, I thought I'd take you into the vineyard. You'll join me amongst gnarly old vines Zinfandel. The vineyard and the winery have a good story to tell. Then we'll travel down to the South Central Coast to meet up with the sommelier at one of the big producers in Paso Robles. Strap yourselves in. We're traveling on the wine road.
So when my dad came over, he met this gentleman by the name of Cesare Barbieri, who planted this vineyard in 1900. No herbicides, no pesticides have been sprayed here since its original planting. It's been dry farmed the whole time.
Wine's not a commodity, and the more you try to fit it into that box, the more you have to really manipulate it, and what we're trying to do is stay traditional on it and show a wine that shows the vintage character.
He's Jim Jerichares of Justin Winery. You may have seen their isosceles or justification on store shelves. They're wines that check all the boxes. Their story is coming up later. A few weeks ago, with harvest looming in the Russian River Valley of Sonoma County, I met up with Gus Gamba at his vineyard and winery. I tell you, as you walk among the 100-plus-year-old vines, you could almost hear them whispering their tales of seasons come and gone. Or maybe it was just a slight morning breeze. After wandering through the vines and tasting some grapes, we sat down in front of the huge wooden doors of his winery to chat about his vineyard, his wine, and his family. I've been wanting to talk with a wine grape grower because people have been asking me questions about the weather lately and how it affects the growing season. Aside from some of the heat spikes we've had, I've had questions about all the rain that fell this past winter and spring. Did it help or did it cause any issues?
Well, I think, we had significant rainfall this year. It was between 35 and 40 inches here in Russian River Valley in Sonoma County. And for a dry farm vineyard like this one, the Gamba State Vineyard, it was important to have that rainwater come in and provide that moisture to the soil. The rains continued on into the late spring. And so that was a little bit of a concern for some people, but the concern was that, it would affect the set, but everything was fine. So everything went smoothly. It was a cool spring, so that sort of set us back a little bit initially, 7 to 10 days, roughly. But, we had a nice growing season, really an ideal growing season this summer, which was great. And then, earlier in the month here of August, we had some temperature rises and really kind of sped things up and brought a lot of people back to where they were last year in terms of ripening. Overall, I think the rain's been great. It's always a blessing to have rain, fill our reservoirs and, saturate the ground with water. So, yeah, I think it was terrific.
And that roller coaster ride we've been on lately where it was 85 one day and close to 100 the next probably didn't make too much difference since the vines do shut down around like 90 degrees, don't they?
Yeah, about 90, 92 degrees they start to shut down and they can start to dehydrate a little bit. The vines made it through nicely. I've walked the vineyard several times since those heat spells and everything looks really good. I'm maybe a few days behind just here at this particular vineyard site, but things are on track. And it looks really good. And the fruit looks great. The fruit tastes phenomenal. It's great acid, great flavors developing. So I'm really excited for the 2019 wines.
Yeah, I grabbed a berry on the way back over here to sit down. And it's tasting pretty nice. So you mentioned the word dehydration. And you told me earlier you dry farm out here. But the Zinfandel, especially the old vine Zinfandel, roots go deep. So they know how to find the water, don't they?
Yeah, and a lot of people are sort of confused about what old vine really means and if there's a difference, and there is a difference. The difference is that the root system for old vine vineyards really reaches down as far as they need to go to find water to have a consistent source of water. And so in any given year, if you have a drought or if you have too much rain, the vines self-regulate, so they provide enough water to the vine. In a year where we don't have a lot of rainfall, there's that source they're drawing from. A younger vine vineyard, on the other hand, has a shallow root system, so it is very dependent on what happens weather-wise. And of course, you know, I mean, if we have a drought, you know, people come in, they have wells, they'll go ahead and water. But then you have to monitor that system, and it's just a little more challenging. I think the gist of it is that you're going to get more consistent fruit, consistently ripe and quality fruit from an old vine vineyard, and you're going to get some flavor profiles that are a little different because of the root system reaching down so far and exposing themselves to all the different types of nutrients that are available to them.
Do you have multiple aged vines on the property, or were they all planted about the same time?
Well, the lion's share of the vineyard, the majority of the vineyard, except for a couple of smaller blocks, was planted in 1900. It's the original planting. So, and the gentleman who planted it, interestingly enough, is from the same area of northern Italy where my dad's from. So when my dad came over, he met this gentleman by the name of Cesare Barbieri, who planted this vineyard in 1900. And my dad took over. And of course, you know, that's how we have the provenance for making the statement that no herbicides, no pesticides have been sprayed here since its original planting. It's been dry farmed the whole time. And so that's pretty significant.
Yeah. What year did your dad meet Cesare?
So that was in the 40s. So Mr. Barbieri was, he was retirement age, beyond retirement age, but they hit it off really well, being that they were from the same area in northern Italy. And my dad worked alongside with Cesare for many years. He didn't want to retire. And this is not really an occupation where you feel you have to retire. You really want to continue on and on. It's just such a wonderful occupation. And they did for many years. And so we got a lot of history from the vineyards. I mean, it's a historic vineyard. It's one of the oldest vineyards in the county. And being that it's dry farmed and organic, I think that makes it even more special.
You mentioned you're the sixth generation grower in the family. So prior to your father, that means the other four generations were back in Italy?
Yes, in northern Italy. We actually still have some property there in northern Italy we visit. You know, I've taken our family back for many visits. It's just outside of Barolo, northern Italy, in Barbaresco area. And just beautiful, beautiful area for growing wine grapes. If you've ever been back there, you know they produce some outstanding wines and just beautiful vineyards there.
Unfortunately, Old Vine Zinfandel is slowly disappearing, much in the way of an endangered species. Do you feel that with the efforts of farmers like yourself, the Zinfandel advocates and producers, and the Historic Vineyard Society, that trend could slow or even reverse itself?
Yes, absolutely. So one of my missions in life, my primary goals, is to preserve as many old vine vineyards as I can. You know, the network that my father established with a lot of growers, I've continued on. I'm on the board of directors for ZAP, Zinfandel Advocates and Producers.
I was going to look that up because I thought you told me that once before. And so, yeah, you're a part of ZAP.
Yeah, I'm on the board. So we do a lot of work to preserve old vine vineyards and just Zinfandel in general. It's got such a significant historic connection with California. And, you know, our mission is to get that word out and get people excited about it. And it's been great. You know, people have been responding. You know, varieties go through sort of trends of popularity and wane in popularity. But Zinfandel is a consistent variety that's been around a long time and will be here for many, many years to come.
I think Zinfandel shares the notoriety of being California's heritage grape, along with Mission grapes as well. But Mission's not widely planted anymore, so Zinfandel is definitely a California's heritage grape.
It is, indeed, and, you know, I'm proud to be a part of it. Of course, there's some iconic producers that I'm thrilled to see that they're producing these wines that are just incredible and turning a lot of people on to Zinfandel. And being right in the heart of Russian River Valley, you know, the Gamba State's got the great location. So that's really the blessing for me. You know, it's really the vineyards that you know, do all the work to provide the wines. I mean, the winemakers are just simply the stewards of the land, and we're just lucky to be working with the fruit.
Gus Gamba of Gamba Vineyards and Winery. As the name suggests, he's also making wine out of an historic European-looking vine-covered stucco building. Yet he put a lot of work into making it as energy efficient as possible, and that's where he stores his wine and holds tastings. I asked if he was the first to make wine in his family.
So yeah, my father always made wine for us at home, and so that's where I learned to make wine as a young boy. And it was sort of our project together to one day start the winery. And before that happened, my father passed away. But you know, I wanted to realize the dream, so I continued on. And my wife and I, Paulette and I, we threw ourselves into it. We built the winery, and we've been producing Zinfandel from the estate vineyard here and other vineyards now, many other vineyards since. Well, it's like going on 20 years now. Yeah, and
1999, I think.
Yeah, 1999 is when we started the initial process, and the 2000 was actually the very first release of Gamba. So we're coming up on 20 years next year.
Right. You're working with some other vineyards, and they're helping you out with some of your single varieties you might be producing in the future, and you do some blends as well.
That's true. The nice thing about working with some of the growers I work with is they really allow me space and to really provide the input and management advice so that I can grow the grapes the way they really should be grown to produce the style wine that I'm after. And yeah, it's really great, you know, working with the Masana family, which is the historic Bastoni ranch that was originally planted in 1905, working with the Star Road Vineyard, was planted in 1920, another vineyard site, Doman, planted in 1930, Fistolera over here on Olivet Road, planted in 1930. So trying to, and another one actually over on Piner, the Winberry Vineyard, another historic vineyard owned by the DeVries family. Just trying to do my part to preserve these old vine vineyards and continue that legacy of wonderful history that we have.
Speaking of history, boy, your logos are classic. I really like your Gamba logo, which has the little cherub, is it on there?
Little cherub overseeing sort of the process of growing and winemaking. And we have
like Dionysus or
whatever you like. I mean, Bacchus, whatever you like. But the idea was to create a motif that showed really the marriage of food and wine. So there's oak leaves there, there's olive leaves there, there's grape leaves there, that all represent, there's wheat stalks at the bottom of the motif there underneath the cherub. And so that just represents the whole marriage of food and wine. That was sort of the idea behind the design there.
And your Etrusca label has an ancient painting from the past.
Yeah, so Etrusca came about, I really wanted to reach as far back into my family history to find out, where it all started and why I'm doing what I'm doing today. And it sort of led me down this path where I found it was actually the ancient Etruscans, who are the pre-Italians, that actually were the first culture to plant wine grapes on the Italian peninsula. And so exploring that further, looking at all the work the Smithsonian has done to research and just reading all the papers from the academics that study the Etruscans, I found that, they brought winemaking all around the Mediterranean. I've read that they introduced winemaking to the French. Just a fascinating culture. The imagery, the artwork came from Lazio, Italy. It's actually a tomb painting of a noblewoman, an Etruscan noblewoman named Velia Velka, and that's why I named the first wine Velia. Okay. And that's a blend. It's a proprietary blend, Zinfandel based. Typically, but it changes. But I just really wanted to honor, and pay homage to my past. And I just found these wonderful Etruscan images and artwork that I'm creating an entire line around. And it's just, it's wonderful to encourage people to also explore their own roots, their own family roots. I think that's important. And having that connection to the past is very important to me.
And what a past you have. And it's great that you're aware of and have been able to follow that heritage back to Italy. And speaking of classic appearances, your vineyard here has that traditional head-trained Zinfandel look to it. But you also train your vines to go a little higher.
Yeah, and the reason why I brought them up a little bit, you don't want to bring them up too high, but you know, I do want to get the airflow around the canopy. I want to get the sunlight exposure. It's important. You know, the grapes that have a little bit more sunlight are going to be a little more fruity. If they're ensconced in a canopy, they have a tendency to get bring on more herbaceous notes. And that's not what I'm looking for in my wines. So, you know, I brought them up just to bring them off the vineyard floor. You don't really want the fruit too close to the vineyard floor either. You're going to get other problems there with bunch rot and things like that developing, because all of the cold and moisture settles to the bottom and it goes, finds the low spots in the vineyard. And so bringing them up allows better airflow and sunlight.
And your pickers are happier too.
They're happier too. Yeah. Because yeah, I mentioned that earlier, didn't I? Yeah. They don't have to bend over all the way to the ground and pick a head or prune a head prune vine, which initially this vineyard was all head prune. So not necessarily the goblet style that was raised a little bit. They were actually giant heads on the vineyard floor. But, we brought those up over the last, 30 years or so. And we've got a better fruiting zone. As I said, you know, better air circulation and sun exposure and hopefully better wines.
I imagine it varies from acre to acre, but what's your typical yield per acre?
Here, intentionally, I drop fruit if, you know, we prune back to 1 to 2 spurs, and it's typically about a half ton to the acre, or 3/4 of the ton to the acre. And I just don't want to push this old vine vineyard. You know, you really... You know, you want enough stored carbohydrate in the root system to produce wine or wine grapes for the coming year without stressing the vine too much. And I think, you know, growing up in this vineyard, I found a really nice balance. You know, it's just really been a joy and a privilege to work in the Gamba State Vineyard here, you know, all my life. And I know the vineyard very well. And, you know, so...
And I would say they know you quite well.
I think so. But it was a real privilege to work with a historic vineyard site like this one.
And that is typical for such an old vineyard to have lower yields. So, not surprising.
Yeah, you know, some of the older vine vineyards can produce up to 2 tons to the acre if you really push them. But I don't really want to do that.
You don't want to push a 120-year-old.
No, of course not. No, you want to sort of cuddle and coddle them, you know, and treat them gingerly and all of that good stuff and pay attention to what they need.
Certainly you must find that the vines have certain unique character to them, especially if they have the smaller grapes. So more concentrated fruit?
Yeah, you know, you're going to get this particular clone. It's a smaller berry. And so that's a lot more skin surface area. So that gives you a lot more pigment in the skin. The anthocyanin that you can pull out can really give you some wines of real, you know, beautiful dark deep color. And of course, the smaller berry, there's less meat of the berry there. And you know, just inside of the skin, there's a thin membrane there that has all the varietal character. And so you have more concentration because there's just less juice there. You know, so that's how we can get these really rich and voluptuous wines from a property like this.
And even though your website says you're sold out right now, you're still doing tastings here by appointment?
Yeah, we do. You know, we do hold back a little bit for our visitors, and so there's tastings available. But you know, we cut it pretty close sometimes. You know, I'm got 2 bottlings scheduled. They're coming up this coming week, so we'll need to have those wines come in because we're running pretty low on inventory. But we'll make it through. You know, we usually do. We've been at it a while, so you know, we kind of figured it out.
Do you have a hidden bottle for your media friends?
Of course I do. More than one.
It'll be nice to get to try it this morning.
Absolutely, yeah. I'd be happy to share something with you.
Because it's actually something I wasn't counting on, so it'll be a nice surprise.
Yeah, absolutely. Wine was made to be enjoyed, you know, and shared. And, I feel privileged that, you know, we get phone calls and emails and contacted by lots of people that have come through and share the wine with their family and friends, and they discover something that they never knew existed, and that's always a thrill for us, because it's sort of brings it all full circle. You know, it's a lot of work to produce these wines, you know, working in the vineyards all the way through the winemaking process and then bringing it to the consumer, and then once you see that it's well received, it really kind of, you know, it just kind of makes you feel kind of good inside, you know, that all that work pays off.
And I would say that you have such an enviable lifestyle here, living this romantic tradition of winemaking. So to hear you say that you're thrilled and honored to have this opportunity, that's just great. You're humble about it.
Yeah, and, you know, I just want to remind people, I mean, it is work. It's a lot of work. But, yeah, I do feel very lucky. I feel very lucky to do what I do, and I feel no need to ever retire, which is a really great feeling too. But, you know, having three children that are interested in continuing, you know, the family legacy of wine growing and winemaking is really, makes me feel really great. So I'll try to share that with them as long as I can.
Andy's not that old, so he'll be doing it for quite a while. What an incredible opportunity he was fortunate enough to be born into. Agostino Gamba, but you can call him Gus. You know, he lives on a usually quiet rural road, but as we started the interview, the landscaping crew at the house across the street kicked up the leaf blowers. They were blowing through the entire interview. It's too bad you had to hear that white noise in the background instead of birds chirping peacefully. When I get back from this short, informative break, we'll head down south to Paso as we continue on the wine road. And now it's time for Wine Uncorked. Did you know that King Tutankhamun's journey into the afterlife included wine? When King Tut's tomb was sealed in 1322 BC, there were approximately 26 amphora, or containers, of wine included. These were found when the tomb was opened in 1922. Following a study by Spanish scientists in 2004, it was determined they contained both red and white wine. This predates Egyptian white wine references by about 1,500 years. Until then, it was presumed only red wine was made in the region. What I find remarkable is the amphora were labeled with the year, the name of the winemaker, and vineyard. Even comments such as, "Very good wine." Sure, he was young, but apparently the boy king deserved the best. We're back on the wine road. Thanks for sticking around. Now I'm going to reach back into the archives for a trip to Paso Robles, or as many call it, Paso Robles. The town is located in the South Central Coast wine region, just north of San Luis Obispo. You'll find a number of grand wineries in the area, like you see in Napa Valley, and winding roads, much like the ones you see meandering through northern Sonoma County. Justin Winery is one of the larger producers down there. My wife and I were honored to have their staff sommelier, Jim Jarakaris, give us a tour of the caves and provide the history of the winery. By the reverb you'll hear, you can tell we sat in the large wine cave tasting room for this interview. Prior to purchasing 160 acres in the Adelaida district of Paso, proprietor Justin Baldwin worked in London. That gave him easy access to the French Bordeaux region, which really struck a chord with him.
Yeah, and he was most impressed with Chateau Margaux. And when you look at our early vintages and all of the techniques that we used and everything, he pretty much went to school on that and tried to do, you know, tried to emulate that. But of course, the climate's really different and everything, so you're going to end up with a different dynamic in the wine, you know, happily.
This is a real good area for blending wine. And you almost see more blends with wineries than you do standalone wines.
Yeah, and we're kind of based in the Bordeaux blend, which would be, you know, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cab Franc, and a few other varieties occasionally. But when you look at Paso Robles in a general sense, we're kind of known for what we call inside, you know, we call them renegade blends because they don't really exist elsewhere. But we found that you can take a little Zinfandel and put some Mourvèdre in it, and all of a sudden it turns into something that it never was before. And you've got some folks that are really expert at doing that. We've got one of our club wines that we do that's like that with some Cab and Petit Syrah, Petit Verdot, and some Malbec in there. And it's a bit of an unusual blend, but it really, really comes off nice.
It certainly adds a level of creativity to what you can do.
It's the beauty of the new world. I mean, the old world is pretty much locked into specific grape varieties and everything. And when you think about an area like Paso, we've got some producers that actually came from France. And they wanted to put some of these things together that they couldn't do in their home territory of, you know, Bordeaux or, you know, wherever. And it's kind of interesting to see that playing out.
Yeah. And it does get hotter here, certainly, than Bordeaux.
It's very hot here. So it's not unusual in August where we'll see temperatures of 105 to 110 degrees. Pretty much we'll be over 100 degrees for a few weeks. But the distinctive thing about the area here is everybody talks about what they call diurnal swings, which are the difference from day to nighttime temperature. We see, like, you know, commonly high 40s, 50 degree differences. So if it's 105 or 110 during the day, at nighttime we'll get down into the lower 60s or maybe even the upper 50s. And what it does is it tends to preserve a nice crisp acidity in the grapes. And what that does is it keeps the wines nice and fresh. Even though we do have a more of a fruit concentration at the end of the year because of the heat, everything freshens out really nicely. So there's a lot of information there, but it cleanses your palate really nicely, and the wines appear much more balanced.
How many estate vineyards do you have now?
We're up to four, of our own vineyards here, and some of them are as recent as 2 or 3 years ago.
You do source some other vineyards as well, though, because with the amount of cases you have, you need a lot of resources.
Yeah, we're not as big as a lot of people think we are. You know, I mean, we're kind of the low end of medium, basically, but as far as California is concerned. But, yeah, and our we call them our estate growers because, really, we have a partnership with them, and we kind of a lot of the techniques we use on our estate vineyard are helpful to them, and it helps us to get better fruit as well, too. But we've got long-term relationships. And they were essential to growth at a time where we couldn't buy property, but we needed to expand. So it's a nice family, basically, that we've got of growers, and we get some really outstanding fruit from them.
At the time of this recording, Justin was bottling about 100,000 cases a year. I said to Jim, at that level, it's difficult to keep that handcrafted ability. But from what he was telling me, they were strict about maintaining hand-picking, hand-sorting, and crafting. And that effort is reflected in the mouthfeel and rich flavors of Justin's wines.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. Where we haven't compromised is, you know, we want to make the wines traditionally. I kind of kid around and say that we behave like we're a 1,000-case winery in that the sorting techniques that we use is by the berry. Everything is hand-picked. And even though we've mechanized some of the sorting, we're still getting, you know, high accuracy, 90% of what you'd get in a hand sort, let's say. And that allows us to make really high-quality wine, but we can make a little bit more of it and kind of get it around the country at a good price and everything as well, too. So, like, our Cabernet is just fantastic. I mean, you know, when you think about the distribution on that wine and the price and the quality of the taste, you had a chance to taste that wine. I mean, it really stands out in that price range. And I always say people have good palates. I mean, even though they don't realize it, but they can tell the difference between a wine that shows some quality, especially at a good price.
Right. And a lot of the wines made by some of the larger producers, they have to maintain a certain level of expectation every year, year in and year out, with their wines. Their consumers expect it to be a certain way, whatever year it happens to be. And here you can have some flexibility with your wine.
Yeah, and I think that's an important part of the wine business that, I mean, people that understand wine, and especially people who cellar wine and kind of see it evolve, understand that each vintage is going to have its own character. And in California, that's not really a bad thing. In an area like Bordeaux or Burgundy, where you have these years where it's catastrophic, you'll get a hailstorm or really some poor weather during harvest, we're pretty blessed in California with a pretty consistent climate. And so most years, I mean, you'll get a slight fluctuation, but it's the character of each vintage. If you're making a quality wine, the character of each vintage really should show out. Wine's not a commodity. And the more you try to fit it into that box, the more you have to really manipulate it. And what we're trying to do is stay traditional on it and show a wine that shows the vintage character, but at the same time is friendly enough that people are going to be able to understand it. And our climate here and everything just helps us to do that really easily.
Yeah. Justin's flagship wine, which has been crafted now for over 25 years, is the Isosceles. Like the isosceles triangle, it features varying degrees of three contributing factors. In this case, the three wine varieties, Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, and Merlot. Now, to avoid a critical response from you math geeks out there, unlike the isosceles triangle, there are not two equal percentages of either wine variety.
It's styled after the classic Bordeaux wine. So when you think about what these grapes function as in the blend, Cabernet is the mainstay. And I always looked at photography because I have a little bit of a background in photography. But Cabernet is like the main light. It's the key light. And then Merlot is like the fill light. So the key light creates a shadow, you know, on one side. Like if you're taking a portrait, there's a shadow on the side of the face. Well, you want to fill that in a little bit so there's some information there and still make it dramatic. And then like Cabernet Franc is like a key, it's like a kicker light or something where you shine it on the hair or maybe get a little sparkle in the eye or something. So those three grapes as blending components have their own job to do. And in the hands of a really talented winemaker, they're going to be able to kind of, you know, decide what percentage it needs in order to kind of make that wine speak.
But then with your isosceles reserve, you cheat a little bit and you have five varietals in there. So you kind of get away from the isosceles. As I joked earlier, you reserve the right to alter the shape of your isosceles.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. In 2008, we actually had a little bit of Petit Verdot in the blend. So we didn't change the name, but there were four grapes in the isosceles that year. So, but that's okay. Yeah, and you know, but isosceles reserve is kind of our, we take all the A-plus grade fruit before we do our blends and reserve it or set it aside, and then essentially we construct a separate blend of that year from those top notch. And what we do is we allow ourselves for more complexity and more control over the blend as well too, typically what they do in Bordeaux. So Cabernet Sauvignon in the left bank or the western region is the key grape, and then they'll blend Merlot and Cab Franc. Now Petit Verdot is used to some extent as well too. And falling to the wayside is Malbec, which actually came from a little bit further south of there, but had been used in Bordeaux for many, many years. But what we find is each one of those tends to add something to the blend. And that's what we're looking for is, you know, that little bit of extra, you know, spice or that little bit of extra structural integrity or the little bit of color or the little bit of something that each of those grapes is gonna add to the blend.
Another blend I enjoyed that day was Justin's Savant. It's a Syrah Cabernet blend. The current 2017 release features 65% Syrah. The warmer climate of Paso Robles enhances the smoky, meaty element of the Syrah. There's spice as well and ripe dark fruit.
Yeah, what we wanted to do on that wine is showcase the two grapes that are really showing well in Paso Robles right now. Of course, Zinfandel is our heritage grape here, but Cabernet is the next, you know, and actually the most planted grape in the AVA. But Syrah's got a really excellent reputation in the area. And the representation of Syrah is fruit-driven, black fruit-driven, but because of the acidity and the crispness that we're able to get, we're able to pull that off without it being really jammy. And then, of course, the savory components, the little smoky, peppery kind of quality that you get from Syrah is really very alluring. So when you combine Syrah and Cabernet together, the Cabernet kind of makes it a little more elegant. It kind of takes the rusticity out of the Syrah just a little bit. So I like to say that wine has real table manners because of that, because it's an interesting interplay between Cab and Syrah.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, you know, you're right. And it's got a totally different nose than when you're smelling isosceles or any of our cab-based wines.
Right. Well, your wines in association with the elegance of your tasting rooms here at Justin. Doesn't surprise me this morning I was reading that Food and Wine magazine named Justin as one of the world's best tasting experiences. That's quite a claim, and I think you guys live up to it.
Yeah, we're really honored with that as well, too. We don't take any of that for granted, but we've worked really hard, and most of the facilities have been upgraded within the last 2 years as well, too. So we're really happy to say that the customer experience is the best that it's ever been. We've got outdoor picnic areas, but also in our tasting room, it's a three-tiered going down a hillside, and we do a lot of outdoor tasting. The weather here is really outstanding. But, and we have a members facility as well, too, for our Wine Society members. So, I mean, you know, a little nicer treatment and everything, but of course they deserve it, and, you know, they kind of, you know, they're our core base, basically, so.
And also for your guests, you offer an inn and a restaurant here on the property.
Yeah, we sure do. Kind of all-inclusive. In fact, we have a lot of people that come here, and they'll spend the whole weekend here.
Right.
They don't even leave the property, which is fantastic because there's a lot of things to do. In the summertime, we're doing seminars and all of that. But we've got four rooms in our inn. Breakfast is provided, so I guess technically it's a bed and breakfast, but it's a bit more upscale than that. It's very, very nice. And, of course, we have a restaurant on the property as well, too. Very small. It's about 8 tables. And the idea behind it is to provide a world-class dining experience. We actually have a wine list with wines from all over the world. We've curated this, so we've got, you know, Premier and Grand Crus, as well as, you know, first through fifth growths from, you know, Bordeaux as well, too, and you name it. I mean, it's a nice experience, and the chef is truly innovative. He's a big fan of cuisines from cutting edge to traditional ethnic cuisines as well, too, so.
And when does the swimming pool go in?
It's funny. We used to have a swimming pool in the old iteration.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, we kind of took it out because we really felt we wanted to expand the tasting room over to that area and kind of provide a better experience for the people coming here.
Well, you're becoming a whole new thing at that point.
Yeah,
anyway.
I guess so.
The in-house sommelier Jim Jerikaris of Justin Winery in Paso. You can find some of Justin's wines on grocery and liquor store shelves or visit justinwine.com. I love the look of their elegant black bottles with minimal branding. There are so many wineries crafting excellent wines in Paso Robles. It's well worth the trip to spend a few days there. Thanks for joining me on the Wine Road today. Get many interesting tidbits on my website, onthewineroad.com, and on Facebook as well. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at JDWineRoad. Music on today's show was composed by Eric Darkin, Marlo Baker, Rob Bagshaw, and Derek Austin and Patrick Wilson. And remember, life is too short to drink bad wine. I'll catch you on the road again soon.